underlined. And he brought that old ugly Bible with him on this trip, and he helped me to get okay with Christ, Christianity, and the word Jesus. Didn't shove it down my throat. He gave me an understanding of it. So I had a prejudice. You follow me? It was a prejudice that I had that made me uncomfortable in that setting. I had a certain antipathy.
Can you repeat that preconceived idea?
This allows new information. It's kind of like when people start talking about Hondas.
Yeah.
You get it?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Abby, Larry drives a Nissan. Now, when the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. You know, when somebody pulled me aside and they suggested to me that, Christian, you know, maybe you don't have a relationship that you want with God. You know, and Earl always has the great comeback, you know. He walks in to see his sponsor, Donald Madden, and Donald looks right at him and says, Earl, you can't be mad at a God you don't believe in. Of course, you turn around, you go home and try to figure that one out all night. He says, I didn't like the idea. I could go for a conception as a creative intelligence, universal mind, a spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens. However loving his sway might be, I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. Now again, Ebby's walking in. He's bringing Shep Cornell. He's bringing Sieber Graves. He's got Roland Hazard. He's got this contingency of first century Christianity, and these guys are trying to force feed the blood and power of the Lamb, the redemptive powers of the blood of Christ. They're trying to preach this to Bill, and Bill won't hear it.
He's puking it up.
Because Bill's got an answer. Again, master argument. He has got an answer for everything. He's just about smart enough to hang in any setting. And he knows a lot about this because his teachers, Mark Whalen, his grandfather, everything he read in books, long-windy arguments, he had everything figured out up here. But yet Ebby, and this is the part that Ebby did. Ebby brought the pain. Ebby brought the truth. And he laid it in Bill's lap, and they're trying to get him to hear it. It's like, you ever tried to help somebody who doesn't want help? You know they need help. They don't know they need help yet. And you're trying to convince them of the need for this. And Ebby is preaching, again, what Oxford Group taught him. And then he basically does something that the Oxford Group does not teach. He says, Ebby suggested what then seemed a novel idea. Now, they make this sound like it's very simple, like, Ebby pulled Bill close over a cup of coffee and suggested this. That's not what happened. Bill would wear you out and piss you off because you're trying to save his life and he doesn't want his life saved because he doesn't need it. Now, he thinks he needs it, but he doesn't want what you got. But Bill has something going for him. Bill doesn't want what he has either. So then Ebby suggests this. He says, why don't you choose your own conception of God?
And that's in squiggly writing. And they later asked Ebby, they said, Ebby, where did that come from? He said, I don't know. What had happened? Bill had worn him down. And that was the only comeback he had. And when he did it went, argument stopped. How do you argue with that? Mm-hmm. I mean, no, I won't do that. Fine, Bill.
Choose your own conception. That says that statement, that I can choose my own conception of God, hit me hard. I love that. When you suggest that to a new guy, listen, you don't have to believe as I believe, but do you believe that there's something out there? And they're like, you can do that? You know, and then, of course, you get the phone call about the tree or the doorknob. And I always like the way Scott Redman talks about the tree outside, you know, the leap of faith, you know, my tree. And then you wake up one morning and the city's cutting down your tree. And as you're chasing the chipper down the road, you're like, God, help me. All right. You know, it's that leap.
It's like, so, I've done a lot of H&I meetings, jails and spin drives. And one time I was doing one at Charter Petrie Hospital in Atlanta. And there was this girl sitting over there. She had the arms crossed and just contempt. And you could just see her bristling, the steam's blowing out. And I started talking about God. And she stood up and said, where are you headed, honey? She says, I knew you were going to bring up God. She says, my goodness, can't you guys just get through one meeting without talking about God? And I said, no. And she said, I'm out of here. I said, whoa, ho, ho, ho. I said, could I ask you one simple thing? She said, arms are crossed and she's just shaking. And I said, do you believe that I believe? And she, yes. I said, cool. We got something to work with. Sit Step your two. Ass down. You know, I mean, we got to start somewhere. Do you believe I believe?
Sure.
And if you're in a room with me for 3 minutes on this gig, there ain't no questions. I'm in. I'm all in.
Yeah.
So we got to start somewhere, and that's what Ebby did. He says, choose your own conception of God.
He found the hole in the argument. We all got an argument. We all got our way of defending what we don't know, and he hit Bill with a question that he couldn't answer. And it says, that statement hit me hard. That statement melted that icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years.
Icy. It was a very cold place. Not friendly at all. Intellectual mountain.
I stood in the sunlight at last.
Here's just some squiggly writing.
Now, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning.
Second step. You want to write that in because Bill's about to blow through these steps. And keep in mind, guys, Bill ain't got a year. He's still freaking and shaking and snaking.
Yeah.
So he's taking the first step. He's taking the second step.
He says, I saw that growth could start from that point. You know, the 12 and 12 talks about willingness being the key that opens the door. It just opens the door. It doesn't kick it open. It just merely unlocks it. You know, so he goes on to say, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Well, of course I would. Then he goes on to say, thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last. Now, Bill has an experience here. He doesn't have just an intellectual comprehension. He goes, at long last I saw, I felt, I believed. He has an experience on multiple levels.
We're talking about this in your package. You've got this thing we call the arch chart. This is something that Joe and Charlie devised some years ago. And what we're talking about here, this is the arch, the new and triumphant arch through which we're going to pass free men. And we're building this thing. But over the next several hours, we're going to stay on step one. That's where we're at right now. We're on step one. We were on step one last night. We got two more chapters on step one. Willingness. This slab of concrete right here was poured many years ago. And I can assure you, there's some guys in here in construction, when they poured this slab, they made sure that the weather was perfect. It wasn't raining, it wasn't too cold, because this stuff won't set up. Because they knew they were going to build this fabulous structure on this thing, and it was going to house thousands and thousands of people over the years. So they made sure that the conditions were right, the proper ingredients were in place to pour this slab. Complete willingness was enough for me to make my beginning. He says, I saw and I believed. Step two, believe or become willing to believe. These are the cornerstones of this arch. Okay?
He says, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The toughest question that I was asked, the most humbling question that I was asked, I didn't have an answer for. And for me, my spiritual growth began when I uttered this three-word answer. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I ain't got it figured out. I don't know. And there's something that happens when I set aside what I think I know in order to have a new experience. And that's all we're doing. And when we sit down with somebody, suggest to them that maybe their relationship with God is a bad relationship. Maybe they can have a better relationship. Maybe they can have... I have a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. You can do that math real quick, and there's a lot of friction. I knew everything I needed to know about God by the time I was 7 years old. I knew his middle initial was H. And my parents' religions frequently condemned one another, you know? And if you thought it, you might as well have done it. You're going to hell for it, and I'm never going to be good enough because I didn't go through catechism, so I'm not going to be able to even go up and get that wafer and that little bit of juice, you know? And I didn't fit in, and I knew it. And they let me know that I didn't fit in. But yet they were unwilling to work together to come to some common agreement. So I had this bad taste in my mouth when it came to religion anyways. So I can really hook up with all of this. And my first sponsor suggested, why don't you choose your own conception? And he basically had me do a third step exercise. He had me write out my own conception. A one ad. started like this. Wanted one higher power. Must be all-knowing, all-powerful, all places. He suggested if I had put it omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent in place, my conceptions, I take them out of any box I will ever put them in. And then I put some like parameters on them. I mean, how immature was I to start putting down some guidelines for God? But he suggested to me that my old conceptions were inadequate. They were going to fail me utterly. What he suggested to me is that maybe I could have a new relationship, one I'd never had before. And it's been since my experience. I sponsor a guy, his first higher power was Jerry Garcia. It's right after Jerry died. And that was his higher power. And as far as he knows, there was a purple bear up in heaven kicking around, doing the full kick, doing the dance. Yeah, I mean, I've been to many a show. And there's some great, great examples of our fellowship running around here, and they got higher powers in all shapes, sizes, and forms. It makes no difference to me. But the evidence of that higher power in their lives makes a difference to me. They're sober because they've tapped into that power. Not because of what it's named or how it's shaped or where it came from, but the fact that they have it. That's the key thing here. He says, a new world came into view, and then he goes on to qualify it. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral, Winchester Cathedral, burst upon me. For a brief moment, I'd needed and wanted God. There'd been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came.
Okay, this is the third time that Bill has made reference to his visit to Winchester Cathedral. In the book, Pass It On page 60, it says, an epidemic kept Bill and his regiment detained at a camp near Winchester in England. The fighting was going on in France. The battle that he imagined was in his head. The explosions, the gunfire, the wounding, the dying was all in Bill's head. We're pretty good imaginers, aren't we? Says, depressed, lonely, and apprehensive about what lay ahead, Bill went to visit Winchester Cathedral. Inside the great cathedral, the atmosphere impressed itself so deeply upon him that he was taken by a sort of ecstasy, moved and stirred by a tremendous sense of presence. God was horrified. Bill was horrified. And he needed some confidence. He needed some reassurance. He needed God. Needed and wanted God. And God showed up. He says, I've been in many great cathedrals since and have never experienced anything like it, he said. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me. And he came. In that moment, Bill knew that everything was all right as it should be. Bill never forgot it. So he was not an atheist. He wasn't even an agnostic. But he needed somebody to come along and say, Bill, choose your own conception of God. Ever how inadequate it may be, it's a great place to start.
Have anybody ever seen the movie Field of Dreams? Kevin Costner goes nuts and builds a baseball field in the middle of the cornfield in Iowa. And everybody who knows him thinks he's nuts. But his family, those close to him, they can see what he sees. And they're out there watching all these dead baseball players running around, throwing the ball, batting it, knocking it around, having a great time. But his brother-in-law, he comes and he sees what's going on, and all he sees is a field. All he sees is waste. And there's some part in this movie, and it's a real neat experience to watch, because I always go back to it because I think about this one experience. The girl falls off. She's choking on a hot dog, and a doctor who's a baseball player, in his younger days he was a baseball player, steps off the field and becomes real. All of a sudden, he sees a doctor helping this little girl. And then he looks around and he's like, where'd all these baseball players come from? They were there the entire time, but the presence of them, he could not acknowledge their presence. Bill recognizes, and he says it here, he says, but soon the sense of his presence, like God ever leaves me, but I can't experience the presence of God when I'm caught up in what? The Bill talks about it here. Worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. How am I experiencing the presence of God when I don't need God? When it's just me running the show, when I'm inflicting myself upon the world, when I'm the man. Now, in the foxhole, when I'm rubbing that lucky rabbit's foot, I'm praying for God and I need his presence. But man, when I'm running the show, when I'm inflicting myself upon you and others, I don't need God. I got this. Larry talks about the guy in Vegas who just struck it rich. He's not in his hotel room on his knees going, God, help me.
Yeah,
where's the need
never,
for God?
You've never heard of a guy that won the lottery and says, God, please help me.
Yeah. Bill was given a book, Varieties of the Spiritual Experience by William James, and when he was laying in detox. And in that book, it suggests that one of the ways to come to a spiritual experience is complete deflation of ego at depth to where you are no longer the most important thing in your life. There's got to be something more important. And Bill experiences that. You know, we're going to go through that here in a second. Now, Bill Wilson, and it says, he writes, and so it's been ever since, how blind I've been.
At the hospital, this is his fourth and final visit. This is December 31st, 1984.
Larry was wheeled into the hospital.
Yeah. December 11th, 1934, Bill's last visit, his final drink.
39 years old, at 2:30 in the afternoon, Bill Wilson walks in. He says, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Now, treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of DTs.
Now, so Bill, he sat on the steps and had a couple of beers.
Yeah. Now, Bill was basically about 4 days into his detox. He could hold a half cup of decaf without yipping it all over the place, you know? He says, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him.
There's Bill's third step. Get your pens handy because Bill's about to go through all the steps here, guys, and he ain't got a year.
To do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch.
Steps 4, 6, and 7.
I have not had a drink since. Now, root and branch is a key thing. I used to do landscaping work, which is a great way, great place to hide out if you're busy drinking. And I used to do this work, and it was a hot August day, and I got the my job assignment was to go to this one house, and in the south they got these boxwoods, these decorative shrubs that go along the front of these houses. And the job was this: dig up the boxwoods so we can plant something else in there in a couple of weeks. It's hot, man. And I grabbed the loppers, and I cut the boxwoods at the base. Right? No harm, no foul. I got a call a couple days later. He said, what'd you do? I said, well, I got rid of the boxwoods. He said, no, you didn't. They're starting to peek through that pine straw. Just removing the visual image of the boxwoods did not remove the boxwoods. Just not acting out in my character defects removes my character defects. You take that old analogy, you got a drunken horse thief, you sober him up, what do you got? Sober horse thief. Bill had him removed root and branch. I usually want to remove just the branch. The root is where the problem is. Selfish and self-centered, that we believe is the root of our problems. And Bill's going to talk on that in the next chapters. So he says, my schoolmate, Ebby, visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
Step 5.
We made a list of people I had hurt or towards whom I felt resentment.
Step 8.
I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Step 9.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within.
Step 10.
Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me.
Step 11.
Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
All right, the 12th step is broken into 3 parts. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Here's Bill's first part of the 12th step, the spiritual awakening part.
Ebby promised when these things were done,
when the steps were taken,
I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
Not some or your drinking problem, but all your problems. All of them.
Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. Yeah, I've heard people sit there and say, you know, fourth step is simple but not easy. It's not where it appears in the book. The book talks about 12th step, simple but not easy. So it says these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric.
What he's talking about here, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, the result was electric. We've heard about Bill Wilson's white light, hot flash experience. He was in Towns Hospital. He was coming out of DTs. He had a minor concussion where he'd run head on into a lamp pole. But he was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and he invited God into his life, and God showed up that night. His account was that the room filled with light. And he said the experience was electric because he had a spiritual awakening or experience, if you will, as the result of doing the work that Ebby had outlined for him.
He says there was a sense of victory followed by peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound.
And as we alcoholics read this passage and we read this literature, we live by comparison, and I invite you very strongly not to do that. I don't know what your experience is. I've got over 21 years. I've known three people in my entire tenure here that had a profound, sudden spiritual experience. And let me assure you, if you've ever met anybody that had that experience, you don't have to question whether they had it. You know it. Mine was educational over a period of time. I believed that you believed, but you needed to show me, not tell me, what you did to acquire this consciousness. You with us? Bill Wilson had a sudden and profound experience, and he says to most men it comes gradually. He says, but to me, it was sudden and profound. Back up in this paragraph, he says, I felt lifted up as though the great wind of a clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. He plagiarized that. His grandfather, Gilman, one of these old Wilson boys that loved to drink red liquor, his family had told him about the prejudices of drink in his family and his heritage. And Bill, remember earlier in the story, he says he didn't pay any attention to it. He didn't sign that temperance pledge. His grandfather liked to drink red liquor and show his butt. Well, one Sunday morning in East Dorset, Vermont, he was sick and tired of being sick and tired and being worthless, and he wandered up on a mountain called Mount Aeolus, just outside of East Dorset. And on top of that mountain, he dropped down on his knees, and he said, God, please help me. And God visited Gilman on top of that mountain that morning. He came down off that hill and he walked down Main Street of East Dorset and burst into the front door of the church where the preacher was giving the morning service. And he said, preacher, excuse me a minute. He went up to the pulpit and he testified. Mm-hmm. And he told them people, he said, God just visited me up on that mountain. And he says, while I was there, I felt as though the great clean wind of that mountain blew through and through me. And he never drank again. So this story about the grandfather was told over family gatherings at Christmas and Thanksgiving over dinner. And Bill had heard that story from his mother Emily for years. So he plagiarized that part of the story. And it's okay, because who knows? Something very sudden and profound happened to Bill that morning that night in the hospital.
It says, for a moment I was alarmed and I called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. Silkworth listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, you know, something's happened to you. I don't understand, but you better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were, Bill.
Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps,
says the good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows that they are real. While I lay in the hospital,
second part of the 12th step,
He tried
to carry this message to other alcoholics.
And that thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others.
This is the first conscious thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill's laying in the hospital just coming out of DTs, and he has the idea of this 12-step program that we're so blessed to be a part of today. Mm-hmm.
Says, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs.
Third part of the 12th step, practice these principles in all your affairs.
Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me.
Imperative, that's pretty strong language. So when all the wheels are off, what's the best thing to do? Grab a wet one.
Come on. Says, faith without works was dead. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. The book tells us here how to grow spiritually. It says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, then it gives us a bad omen. We will not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead.
And they're coming. Not if, but when. They're coming.
If we do not work, we would surely drink again. And if we drink, we would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it's just like that. He says, my wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm.
Enthusiasm. E-N with thus, God. We abandon ourselves with God.
To the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time. I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment.
Damn near died from depression.
Yeah, he had it for over almost 15 years. The writing of the 12 and 12 was done during the writing of this. He says, this sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day.
There we go.
Many times I have gone to old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet.
Here's a promise.
It is a design for living that works in rough going.
You know, we read these, I don't know about here, out here in this part of the country, but in the meetings back in Atlanta, they read this thing called The Promises. And we're sitting there, new guys. How many new guys we got here this weekend? There you go. You're going to hear this document they read around here, probably. It's called The Promises. And you're going to ask yourself, what the hell does this mean? It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, what phase are they talking about? And it says, you're going to be amazed before you're halfway through. Halfway through with what?
The meeting?
The meeting?
Six.
Halfway through with Christmas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I get it. I get it. But why are we... Back off. They're reading a document that comes after the ninth step. We got a new guy that just walked in off the street. You follow? The guy just walked in, and he's going, halfway through with what? Was that 45 minutes into the meeting that I'm going to have this? Painstaking about what? Going and getting a cup of coffee? Or not spilling it on the way back from the coffee machine? Mm-hmm. The point I make is, this book, here's the point, guys. I'm sorry about my little tirade, and y'all ain't seen the last of that. This book is full of promises, hundreds and hundreds of promises. It just so happens the fellowship chose the ninth step promises to read because it's pretty dramatic at the beginning of a meeting. Bill Wilson wrote, and this is not my opinion, this is his writing, if Alcoholics Anonymous ever goes down the tube, it's because we did it. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is the worst thing that ever happened to Alcoholics Anonymous. We got our little designs and ideas. Just don't drink and go to meetings. All right, let's go.
The book says, we commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. I guarantee a lot of people have read this, and I'm going to point something out that was pointed out to me that just blew my mind when I first read it. It says, the joy of living we really have. Even under pressure and difficulty. Not the joy of living I think I got. Not the joy of living I'm portraying to you. The joy of living we really have. Really have. Tangible results. The joy is not indicative of the circumstance. Because I used to dictate, as long as I had all my ducks in a row, everything was great.
But you've learned what?
They're not my ducks.
You're not your ducks.
And if you read Turk's shirt, you can find out whose ducks they are. It says, I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. Not this nebulous hope that it gets better. No, true path to somewhere. It says, I have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted. Feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out.
Promise.
I have seen men come out of the asylum and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities.
Promise.
Business and professional men have regained their standing.
Promise.
There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us.
Promise. A good example of that, I mentioned it last night. I got men that I sponsor that have wives and girlfriends and or wives and, well, wives and girlfriends. I don't have one of those either. Wives, girlfriends, and children. I don't have any of those things. So when they come to me with domestic problems, I'm not your guy. I am not successful in relationships. I don't know anything about kids. Don't have any. So what I have to do is take them by the hand and sit them down in front of Bob Crawford, my sponsor, and have him walk them through it. Because there are problems that I am not going to allow my ego to jump in and say, well, let me tell you what I think. Because I don't know what the hell to do with that. Christian's got a great example of taking problems that a regular sponsor doesn't have the answer for that somebody else might.
One of the first things I actually did right in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did that first year thing. You know, my first sponsor, Don, pulled me aside. He goes, listen. And Don, you'd have to know Don. Don wore sunglasses inside. Don was a real smooth-talking used car salesman, and he always talked real quiet. You got to lean in now. You got to hear, what the hell are you talking about, Don? You know, Don pulled me in. He goes, listen, you're pretty sick, and she's going to be pretty sick because you ain't going to be able to attract anything other than a sick woman. And, of course, my feelings were hurt. So he suggested to me, why don't you work on your alcoholism the first year? Why don't you do the steps as outlined in the book? Well, about 9 or 10 months into our relationship, Don was too busy, I was too busy, and I found another sponsor. And on day 367, I went on my first date. We were engaged within 4 months. So you do the math right there. I'm not thinking right. She ain't thinking right. She ended up having a stroke. She was 23 years old and ended up having what they call a TIA stroke. Little pieces of blood clot were breaking off and going into the back of her brain, and she was suffering dramatic strokes. And we thought they were seizures. We checked her into the hospital, and within 6 hours, she's in the neuro-intensive care unit dying. We're not sure if she's going to ever live. We're not sure if she's going to be a vegetable. And I'm a year and 5 months into my sobriety, and I'm crumbling. And I don't know what to do. And so I start reaching out to y'all. And my sponsor does not pretend to understand what I'm going through. But he calls a guy out in Vista, California. And he gives me a number, Mike Grande. I don't know Mike Grande. I don't want to know Mike Grande. But he suggests that Mike Grande has the experience that you are currently going through. He can walk you through it. So I called Mike Grande, and from 2,000 plus miles away, a guy, a member of this, solid member of this fellowship, walked me hand in hand through the other side. Now, the story's got a happy ending. But the prayer was this. Instead of my selfish needs, he suggested that I pray for her needs. God, help her to walk away from this. I can handle anything. And as I cried myself to sleep that night, because this is my babe, this is my girl, this is my future, this is the woman I want to grow old with. And here's the prayer, God, if you get her through this, I can handle anything. And I prayed it over and over again. God, just help her get through this. I can handle anything. God, help her get through this. Well, within a week, she's outside of the hospital, walking around, laughing and cutting up. She comes back home, and I open the door, and I see her there, fresh skinned and glowing. And she says, I'm going back to school. I'm thinking, great. She goes, and I don't want to marry you. She had second thoughts. God, get her through this, and I can handle anything. I got what I asked for. Now, the privilege of this is that I learned a lot over the last 6 years of my sobriety. You know, and I'm in a first, and I use the word healthy in quotes, because what is a healthy relationship? And you go around the room, you're going to get a whole lot of subjective opinions on that. But I'm in a healthy relationship that's working for me today. But I wouldn't be in the relationship I'm in without having gone through the relationship I was going through. And I'm so grateful that my sponsor at the time did not pretend to have an answer. He came back to what the book suggests, reliance upon God instead of reliance upon things human, but he helped me walk from personal experience with a guy from 2,000 miles away to walk through the other side. Told me, the guy understood how I was feeling, what I was thinking, and what I wanted to do. He told me those things from across the phone. And that's a big deal because identification is crucial. I need to know that you understand how I feel before I'm going to follow what you do, you know? And that's a big deal, and it's just one of the examples. So says in one western city and its environs there are 1,000 of us and our families.
Talking about Akron.
Then a book says, we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek.
Please highlight, underline, bracket that sentence. Because many of us think that we have meetings that we can use for a dumping ground. Go talk about her or it or stuff.
The weed eater.
The book says that we have meetings so that the newcomer can find the fellowship he seeks, mm-hmm. that he craves. That's why we have it, so that we have that shot at that new guy that's vibrating coming in the door, mm-hmm. saying, listen, you ain't got to live like this anymore because we have a solution. It's not about the... Huh? It ain't about you, dude.
Wow.
Just lean back into the fire. It ain't about you. It's about that new guy that had to get up the big balls to walk in the door in the first place because he heard something about A&A. It's about giving this guy, we got one shot at him, guys. If you keep telling him about the weed eater, he ain't coming back. He's going to die in the street. This is the last stop. We got to give him a solution, something he can get his teeth into. And you're going to hear me go on this tirade all weekend long. I'm sick and tired of burying people because we let him slip out the door. Talking about our problems with her, it, all the shit. And it has nothing to do with the treatment of alcoholism. It has nothing to do with the treatment of alcoholism. A guy, you see him raise his hand, my name's Bill. This is my first meeting. Grab him. Tell him about the first step. Tell him about the spiritual solution found in the second step. Get him on his knees that day. Make a decision to go through with the work. If you got a damn weed eater, take it to the shop. It has no place in AA. We're killing people with that crap. He says, we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. They're seeking us. I don't know about y'all. We don't have the 12-step work and opportunity, the privilege of going out and talking to a wet one anymore. The treatment centers have taken that opportunity away from us. So, boy, when that new guy walks in, you let them walk into Glum Light on Thursday night. My God Almighty, they get rushed. But they walk out of there with a sponsor, and my guys will say, you got a sponsor yet? What's that? I'm your new guy. Here's my number. You lay it out. Yes, sir, go back.
You walk into any hospital, and they still have alcoholics.
Yeah, but... Yeah.
So you can make a 12-step call.
Yeah, but they're my experience... is they're not like they were in the day. When I walked in here in 1987, man, my sponsor called and said, get on your britches. We got a wet one over here at Dogwood Motel. Hot almighty, let's go. Lots of fun. Okay.
The book says, at these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in number and power. The asterisk indicates in 2003, there's 103,000. How many you got?
1985 is 58,500.
You got any other numbers to throw out?
1989, approximately 7,600.
Wow.
So for 104,000.
Yeah. See, we're growing in number and power. How cool is that?
106,000.
This next sentence says, an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. I ain't got to be drinking to be in my cups. Screw it. Let my alcoholism raise up in me. Mm-hmm. I ain't very fun to be around, even to this day.
Yeah, I mean, you hear people talk about, well, you know, it's just my alcoholism. And I'm thinking, man, that's such a cop-out. You know, I mean, oh, I chalk it up to my alcoholism. I'm thinking, man, you know what? Let's work the steps and let's get past that. You know, what makes me an alcoholic is my physical allergy to alcohol. That mental obsession coupled with the allergy. That's what makes me an alcoholic. You remove the alcohol from me, my alcoholism kicks in. I don't have to be drinking to experience alcoholism. You know, and we're going to talk about that in a lot more depth. But, man, you remove the alcohol from the alcoholic. What are you left with?
Ick.
Man, it's that nasty. Why would you want to feel like this? You know, and Kip talks about it so well. He says, I don't have a problem with drugs and alcohol. I just have this acute allergic reaction to sobriety. You know, I mean, that's a bad way to feel. And why would you want to do it? God. He says, our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He couldn't or wouldn't see our way of life.
The guy's name is Bill. He actually stayed with Bill and Lois for a minute. He had a gambling problem. He was a salesman. And he had this gambling problem and a drinking problem. And when Bill and Lois would go away to do whatever they were doing, they would come back to find their fine clothes missing. And this guy was stealing your clothes and hawking them to go pay his gambling debts and buy booze. And he couldn't or wouldn't, and he stuck his head in the oven in their kitchen and turned on the gas.
There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. Now, I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity.
You know, we sit in here and we go, you know, I had 13 DUIs before we got this thing. Go do that down the street to Baptist Church. They'll drop on their knees and start praying for you. We laugh right about it.
It says, but just underneath there's this deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. And then most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. When they had the original versions of the pre-printed versions of this book, they were sending around getting different opinions. One of them came back from a Catholic priest, and he said, you know, we've kind of cornered the market on this heaven thing. It used to say, we look no further for heaven. But they changed it to utopia, which is heaven on earth. You know? So there's certain words that were changed to be a little bit more palatable, and that was one of them. We have it here with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in the kitchens multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men.
I'm going to mention one little thing you might want to write in your book. This is about Lois Burnham Wilson. She worked at Macy's for $22.50 a week. She died at the age of 97. And she didn't die until September 5th of 1988. We're running a little ahead of schedule, guys. Let's take five and jump on into this next chapter. When he started writing the book, what did he have, 3 years, Christian?
4 years.
His story was actually written before then. His was one of the first ones written because it was a way of transmitting an experience.
How much time did he have?
I'd have to look up the time periods. I mean, I didn't write that particular date down, but I know that the book started in 1937, which would have put him about 2.5 years, you know, 2.5 to 3 years.
Yes, sir.
Did he send that back and forth?
Don't
know. Oh, it got a lot of editorship. I mean, he sent it to Bob. He sent it to Clarence. He sent it to Fulton Osler. I mean, early versions of the book before it was even finalized were and people would come back. And, you know, Larry's going to talk about one of them and when we talk about how it works. But there was a doctor in one town said, Bill, you can't do this. You can't write must and should. You got to write, you know, ought and, you know, suggestion. You got to because
his story.
Oh, his story was helped edit it down. I think Ruth Hawk actually worked with him on part of his story. But there's a version of it online if you go in, and I think it's original version of Bill Wilson's story, and it's like 10 pages longer. And he goes into much more detail. And so he cut out a lot of redundancy, you know, about his accolades and his alcoholic exploits.
Bill's favorite topic was Bill. You know, we laugh about it, and I pick on Bill a lot, but I'm just like him. You know, in a few minutes, we're going to get over in that fourth step, and people say, the fellowship tells the new guy, you know, watch out for that fourth step. It's a booger. Why? You're writing about your favorite topic, you. There's nothing to be scared of. Fifth step, what's so scary about that? You're talking about your favorite topic, you. Last night, we went over a thing called the alcoholic puzzle. And in essence, the alcoholic puzzle is covered on the first page of your handout. And this is the big book goals. Goal one is the problem. We know what the problem is. It's an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. It's powerlessness. You find that in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. Then there's goal two, the solution. Finding a power. We find that in, that's step two. Chapter 2, there's a solution where we're starting now. More about alcoholism. In chapter 4, we agnostics. And then the goal 3 is action necessary to keep that power once we've acquired it. So it's kind of a self-explanatory page. And this chapter we're entering into now is chapter 2. And the title of this chapter is There is a Solution. It doesn't say this is one of many. There is a solution.
Bill Wilson paid attention when he was in school. One of the things he paid attention to was classic writing styles. And Bill took a classic writing style and it adapted it for the big book. And the classic writing style is basically this. He's going to tell us what he's going to tell us. Then he's going to tell it to us. And in just in case we forgot it, he's going to tell us what he done told us he was going to tell us. Just in case we, and again, real quick show of hands, how many people tried to quit more than once? So, the first third of the first 164 pages is spent on nothing more than the first step. And it's the step I got to get right. You know, how do I hit bottom? Well, alcohol is going to help me do that. And so when you hear run into somebody who's working on step one, you might smell their breath. Working on step one is drinking. Hitting a bottom is what step one is all about. But hitting a bottom with drinking, you know, it's a neat place.
Once again, anytime they use the we or us, they're talking about the first 100. And again, we're going to go back to that thing called the promises. And it says in there, it says, are these extravagant promises? And you guys go, we think not. You're not the first 100. Because they're asking the first 100, what do you guys think? Are these extravagant? And they say, no, we don't think so, Bill. So, you know, and if you're chanting, cool, go with it. But that's who we think not are. That's the first 100 answering Bill's question. So it starts out here, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, first 100.
Oh. Know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered.
There's that silly word, please underline it.
They have solved the drink problem.
You know, the word recovering, you hear people in meetings say, my name's Tom, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My old buddy Chris Reimer, the one that should be here today, threw us under the bus. He says, if you're saying my name's Tom and I'm a recovering alcoholic, work the damn steps and recover. Word recovering is twice in this book, and one of many ain't even in the first 164 pages. The word recovered's in here 37 times.
The book
past tense.
The book tells us that we're supposed to introduce ourselves as an alcoholic who has recovered. That's what we're supposed to do on a 12-step call and in a situation where we're sponsoring somebody.
On the back, if you follow my motorcycle down the road, the tag says AA Hog. And if you fall in behind my car, the tag says recovered, because I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. One little piece of housekeeping before we get started. We're going to go over some information this weekend that may not be handed out. We may talk about some things. I'm going to say, well, I've got this morning prayer that you ought to see. Well, I'm going to put up here my email address. And if you want these documents, it's aahog1@comcast.net. Shoot me an email and tell me what you're looking for. We've got a ton of stuff. This thing we read last night, what happened? I've got the full 3-page document on my computer. I'd be happy to send that to you. There's going to be some things we go over, and the best thing to do is email me and I'll shoot it to you. We were in Savannah, and I said, guys, we're going to be going over some stuff. If you want this stuff, give me your email address. Well, I came home with 2 legal pad pages of email addresses. I entered them on Monday morning, and Comcast shut me down. They shut me down for 3 days because they said, you're sending out spam. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm saving lives. They said, whatever. So if you'll email me, I'll get this information to you. But it's aahog1@comcast.net.
Are those all capitals?
No, small case. Just thank God you can read it. When I write, I look like an amateur gynecologist.
You notice he's saying gynecologist versus proctologist. All right.
If I sponsor you, you might think I'm a proctologist.
Yeah.
I go in with a rotator.
He likes to get in your ass. All right. Book says that we are average Americans. I know that's disappointing for most of us. We're just average Americans. All sections of this country, as many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix.
Now, that's a fact. There are guys in this room today, and in rooms like this all over the country, that I wouldn't hang with. There's some Harley guys in here, and we all got it. We got it going on. I mean, we all know who we are. We got that badge of honor going. But you know something? I'm a high school dropout. I'm a thief. I'm a liar. I'm a dope fiend alcoholic. And I have sponsored two brain surgeons. What the hell were they thinking? And the funnest guy I ever sponsored was a hard-nosed defense attorney out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Glenn Veet. Man, this guy has etched his way into the annals of my mind. This guy was a hammerhead. But you know, what am I doing hanging out with these guys? You know, I want to go sleep with their wife. And they're asking me to guide them on a spiritual path. I'm going, what are you thinking? But we're people that normally would not mix.
But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We're like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined.
There's a lot going on here. What Bill's talking about in the early passages of this chapter, this is the power of the fellowship. I need you. You're vital to my recovery. That's us. Glad you're here. Grab some coffee. Share with me what you've done. Power of the fellowship. Bill's a great writer. And he, if he's talking to fishermen, he's going to talk to them about fishing. About fish, about migration and nets and different forms. If he's talking to sheep, he's going to talk to them about herding. Not sheep. He's talking to sheep herders. He's going to talk to them about sheep and sheep dogs. And
I like the sheep.
See,
better.
You guys. We had a gal come and visit us a couple of weeks ago from Bryan, Texas. She says, my name's Mickey Boudouin. I'm an alcoholic. She says, I'm from Texas where the men are men and the sheep are scared. And she says, where the women are cunning, baffling, and powerful. But he's talking about the power of the fellowship, and he's talking about, in this day and age, the Lusitania and the Titanic had just fallen to the dark depths. And he knew if he brought up this great liner going down, people would relate. Good for us in this day and age. We have fresh in our minds Leonardo DiCaprio hanging over the bow of that boat. But he says steerage to captain's table. Steerage is down there in the engine room with all the banging and the clanging and the heat and the steam and the crap where Leonardo lived. The captain's table's on the top deck, people wearing black tie, eating caviar. They never saw each other in reality. These guys are down here eating bologna sandwiches, and these people are eating leg of lamb. And it says, the feeling of shared, having shared in a common peril. We've all shared in a common peril. Is but one element in the powerful cement. This is a two-part cement we're talking about. We all have a common problem, and we all have a common solution. Two parts of the cement. You with us? It says, but that in itself, this fellowship, is not enough. It says, it would never have held us together if we are now joined. This is a fellowship warning. You got them clubhouses where them guys are hanging out on the porch. They set that attendance sheet down or that court card. And they go out on the porch and smoke for 45 minutes. Y'all got those guys out here? Kind of thought so. You can't get sober by osmosis. You got to sit in here. You got to hear this stuff. And you got to do the work. It doesn't seep in through the pores. So it says that in itself would never have held us together if we are now joined. The fellowship warning. Fellowship ain't enough. Okay?
Bill writes, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution.
Second part of the cement.
We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action.
Action, not thought or talk or discussion, and there's another promise.
This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism.
Great news. Sounds like the gospel of this book.
An illness of this sort, we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can.
Never use the word disease because the disease concept didn't come about until the 50s. Call it an illness, a malady, sickness.
All right, skip down to the fourth paragraph. I apologize, I just jumped in a little bit early. fourth paragraph down in italics says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. There's a guy who used to come to our book study over in, we used to do a men's book study over at the treatment center. He sat in that room. He did not have alcoholism. He would tell you straight up that he was a methamphetamine addict. He sat in that room and he started listening to a lot of the things that we were talking about. All the feelings, the thoughts, the actions, the reactions. All the things that manifest itself in the life of an alcoholic. He walks up to us afterwards and cusses us for a dog and tells us, damn it, you gave me alcoholism. What we did is we helped him get a diagnosis. See, when I got here, I believed that alcoholism only afflicted men over the age of 50 and that they wore trench coats and slept in the doorways. I never once slept in the doorway. I slept in loading docks and underneath the back end of a dumpster. But I never slept in a doorway. I wasn't like them. And I didn't have a trench coat.
Where's that piece of paper you got from Statesboro? It says something about diagnosing alcoholism?
Yeah, I'll find it. We approach somebody until that confidence is there. You know, and you know whether you have that confidence or not. It's a very visual thing. You get that head nodding. And they're not lining up so much with the best example I got. I walked into rooms when I first got sober. It was a meeting makers make it. That's all they preached. I didn't hear anything about steps. We read them. I didn't hear anything about sponsors, but I was told that you needed to get one. You know, I heard all the stuff about God, but it wasn't really necessary. I heard all this good stuff. It wasn't AA. But then I went to it, and I came back after a relapse, which of course happens when you don't work the steps. I came back in, and I went to this meeting of called the Heavy Hitters. The reason I went to the Heavy Hitters is for one reason, because one of them came to our treatment center and told us what his life was like today as a recovered alcoholic. And he was a real light-skinned black guy. And I wanted to go and see what this was all about. So I went to his group, and I knew I was different from the gate. I was the only white guy there. And it was a black men's meeting. And I sat and watched, and I listened. And I sat and I watched, and I listened. And I couldn't get over the fact that I'm in a room full of black men. And I got a whole lot of prejudices that my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents handed down through generations. They had problems with black men. I didn't. But I adopted their belief systems. And I took them as my own, and I never formed my own belief system. And I sat there judging, I sat there comparing, I sat there finding all the differences, and I must have looked nuts. Because all of a sudden, from behind me, a pair of black hands come over my eyes. And as they come over my eyes, I hear this in the back of my head, I hear, shh. All of a sudden, I'm not sitting in a room of black men. I'm sitting in a room full of alcoholics who are suffering from hopelessness and suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And I hear about hope and faith and courage and integrity and perseverance and willingness. I hear about getting sponsors and working steps. I hear about a God manifesting itself in people's lives. I stopped trying to find the differences and I identified with the disease.
Thank you.
And until that was reached, I did not have alcoholism. I merely had an alcohol problem. I didn't understand what it meant to be alcoholic until I stopped paying attention to the shell, and I started paying attention to the man. And that may not mean anything to anybody, but it meant everything to me. And that's so key, because until that is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. You know, it's like Earl going to visit the guy in the hospital. He's got the distended liver hanging out like a football, and he's in 4-point restraints, and he's yellow. And he's looking down at this poor bastard who's going to die from alcoholism. And they look at him and that guy's got, hey, I ain't got a problem. That's my disease. I understand that thought pattern. So
we're going to skip over to page 20, first full paragraph. Yeah, you may already have asked.
So you may have already asked yourself, why is it that all of us became so very ill from drinking? Doubtless, you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body.
So there's that word again. And we're talking about this in this day and age. We're asking ourselves, how can this be true when doctors and professional men and scientists have proved that alcoholism is a fatal malady. Opinion. This is a long definition. I'm going to read it in full. If you want to write it, I'll repeat it. An opinion is a belief or judgment that rests on grounds insufficient to produce complete certainty. It's a belief or judgment that rests on grounds insufficient to produce complete certainty. Make sense? Everybody got it? Need it? Good? It's a belief or judgment that rests on grounds insufficient to produce complete certainty. You know, y'all thought I was going to talk about that other definition of opinion, didn't you? Yeah, exactly right. I love working with a bunch of guys. Mm-hmm. What do you really mean by that? Okay, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, they say there's no cure. We have recovered, not recovering, from a seemingly hopeless state of, no, from a hopeless state of, hopeless condition of mind and body, obsession of the mind, coupled with an allergy of the body.
Then he goes on to suggest, and I like the way Bill Wilson does this, he always lets us make up our own mind. But he asks the questions over and over again. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it,
if you want to get sober,
you may already be asking, well, what do I have to do?
And then he's going to tell us about what this book's all about.
It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically.
Not in a general way, but we're going to tell you how to get over it, dude.
Then it goes on to say, we shall tell you what we have done.
Not what we did. What did we do? Yeah. Well, listen up.
And that's a key thing, because what the Oxford Group taught and what AA is are not the same. They paid a lot of dues in the early days of this fellowship, learning about what works and what doesn't work. Dragging a drunk off a bar stool and taking him to a meeting doesn't work. Bill Wilson learned that the hard way. I learned that my first sponsee, man. He cussed me at one point in time. You know, because here I am trying to demand. I took a book. It's a big book. And I basically oiled up the ends and I tried to shove it in his ass. I tried to make him do this work. I tried to make him do it. I tried. And he finally said, you're a dick. And guess I was. I'm trying to inflict this program upon him. That's not what this book says. We lay it out in front of them. If I cared to have it, that's what Ebby said. That's what Bill said about Ebby. He brought it to me if I cared to have it. We don't try to make anybody get this thing. You know, Bill, Larry always pulls me aside. He goes, it's like trying to teach a pig to sing.
Piss off the pig and you get frustrated.
There you go. So it asks these questions. It says, before going into some detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times people said to us, you know, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't you? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay up that hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. You know, she's such a sweet girl, I think he'd stop for her sake. Doctor told him if he ever drank again, it'd kill him. There he is, all lit up again.
Now these, I bracketed this in my book. This is frothy emotional appeal. And it goes on to say, now these are commonplace observations from society on drinking, on drinkers, which we hear all the time. But in back of these is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. What they're saying there, society doesn't understand us. They don't see us as human beings walking around the planet with a disease. They don't understand the obsession of the mind, that thought that precedes the first drink. They don't understand the allergy that sets in once we start drinking that we can't stop. It goes back to that chick sitting by the pool that tips over the glass of brandy and says, oops. Aren't you going to finish that glass? Oh, no. I'm beginning to feel it.
God.
They don't understand us. I drink a half a glass. I'm ready to do stuff. I want to go meet people. I want to go for a ride. I want to hear about your family.
Especially your sisters.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it charges me up. Let's go.
Yeah. Book says we see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Moderate drinkers, they have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone.
I don't get it.
That's type 1. The type of drinkers. Type 2, we have a certain type of hard drinker. They may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair them physically and mentally. It may cause them to die a few years before their time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, the warnings of a doctor, if these become operative, this person can stop or moderate. Although they may find it difficult and troublesome, they may even need medical attention.
But they can stop. They can stop. It's not our story.
I've seen these buttons, and it says, I'm the guy on page 21. What about the real alcoholic? They may start off as a moderate drinker. They may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of their drinking career, they begin to lose all control of their liquor consumption once they start to drink. The allergy. If I set out to drink one and I drank 15, there may be a problem.
I'm going to skip over to page 24.
Now, they go over a part in here on page 21. We're not going to go into it, but they talk about Jekyll and Hyde. Robert Louis Stevenson suffered from alcoholism. And they took his story of Jekyll and Hyde. If you read the story version, it's about alcoholism. Hollywood got a hold of it. And they Hollywoodified it. They gave it a Hollywood edge. And then he becomes this hideous monster after indulging upon this particular liquid.
Sounds about right.
Top 24, the first
squiggly writing, guys. Pay attention.
Says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
You're talking about the mental obsession, the obsession of the mind. And if you want to add another word in there, it's complete insanity. Because when it starts, it's an insane thought. You know that this time is going to be the same as it was last time. You always end up drunk and in a path of destruction in your wake. But you're without defense. And then we're going to skip forward, guys.
And one of the things we like to do is always dispel those rumors, myths, subtle little stories that you hear, the good sounding stuff, you know? It sounds really good in meetings. It's not in the program, though. And that one is think the drink through.
What does that mean?
Well, the book tells me right here that I cannot bring into consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering. I like the way Scott Lee puts it. I can't remember all the way back into yesterday. You know, you woke up around the toilet again, you tie that little piece of string around your finger, and I'm not going to drink today. About 3 in the afternoon, I'm feeling a little bit better, but I'm not going to drink today. And then about 8 o'clock, I get that phone call, I'm going to eat first, because drinking on an empty stomach is what my problem was, right? I can't remember the pain and suffering of that. That's, you know, if you can't think the drink through, man, I can't. I'm without defense. So anytime I enter any delusion that I have a choice, I'm still running the show. I still think I got power. I still think I got control. I still think that I'm not an alcoholic. I cease to be an alcoholic up here and in here the minute I think I got power and choice. Those are never restored.
We're talking about the mental obsession. There's no allergy in place here. Skip to the bottom of the page, first full paragraph. We're talking about the thinking.
When that sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, they have probably placed themselves beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane.
The book's going to talk about putting ourselves beyond human aid. Let's talk about what human aid really is. These are wives, children, girlfriends, neighbors, good friends, police officers, judges, doctors, men of the cloth. These are human beings. They have no power over your alcoholism, but yet we rely on them to help us. Doc, I just got out of jail, and my wife tells me if I don't stop drinking, she's going to take the kids and the dog and leave. The doc says, well, let me give you one of these. You take two a day for the next month. Well, that's not going to help you. That's human aid. The power that we have to have must come from something outside human, and that's where we're headed with this.
You know, one of the better examples of that is, back in the late 70s, one of the star members of the Saturday Night Live cast did a movie and became a seminal favorite among most of us in this Animal House. John Belushi was the only sober member of that cast during the filming of that movie. He hired a bodyguard to keep him away from drugs and alcohol. paid him well. What happened to John Belushi in the end? He died from this disease. A bodyguard can't keep me away from me. That's a bad spot, man. So it goes on to say, and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane, these stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot.
The word grace, most powerful word in the entire book. Please underline it. And I'm going to give you one of two definitions. Write them both, or the one you prefer. Grace is undeserved favor, or if you prefer, unmerited mercy. Thank God I didn't get what I deserved. I'm only here because somehow, some way, this God that loves me allowed me to slip into a window of opportunity to be present with you in Eugene, Oregon today. Left to my own devices, I'm dying. If you ever heard my story, you'd go, I can't believe you're here. Because, see, God reached down and He gave me a pass. And He didn't give it to me on one occasion or two occasions. It was almost a daily occurrence that He gave me a pass. Because we had this conversation in our room last night. I know what my purpose is today. My purpose is to be right here with you. I stand in the shadow of two self-made millionaires. I'm lucky. I live hand to mouth. But it ain't about what's in my pocket. It's not about my surroundings that I live in. It's about what I get from this vantage point, seeing this. This is my big paycheck. This is the lotto, man. I get to see this on a regular basis. Somebody said to me last night, there's a new guy here, and I saw the lights come on last night. That's what I'm talking about. You stick around to this afternoon. Where do we get into that fifth chapter? And get ready. Tom's got that wheelchair. He says, I got my seatbelt right up under here. Y'all going to need shoulder harnesses this afternoon. And I know I'm setting the bar mighty high, but I just see it happen every week in this deal. That's the payback. Grace. Thank God I didn't get what I deserved.
It says, so many want to stop, but cannot. Bill's nailing the last little nail into the coffin. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation.
He's talking about steps 1 through 5 here.
I like how grandiose he is. He goes, almost none of us. I haven't met one person who was looking forward to doing a fourth and fifth step. You know, and almost none of us. Oh, you're already doing that? Oh, yeah, I do that all the time. No, almost none of us. But the process requires for its successful consummation. In order for me to recover, I'm going to have to do a fourth and fifth step. It says, but we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up that simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet.
If somebody approaches you who has a message of depth and weight, you can identify with the way they thought, the way they drank, the way they acted after the drink. And they say to you, I have a solution for alcoholism that really works. What do? You say, nah, I'll take a pass. I'm good. If you're in the shape that I was in, you're going to take it. And I'm going to just tell you, I don't know what you're doing in your book right now. This is the page we're on. My book looks like Walt Disney puked in it. It's so lined up and marked. This is some heavy-duty stuff, guys.
Book says, we have found much of heaven. And we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed.
It's that spiritual, that's that conscious contact with God that we talked about.
Now, Bill's going to use some subtle language in this next paragraph. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe.
You notice at the bottom of the page it says fully explained in Appendix 2. He's going to bring this up 3 times, but we're going to wait until Bill begs us, and then we'll go over there and read it. But he'll say, fully explain next, and he'll say, please be sure to read that. Yeah. So we'll finally cave in and go do it.
Again, some more subtle language. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous.
Miraculous. It's in a way that can't be explained. We know He's there, but we can't tell you how He got there.
This power has commenced to accomplish those things for us, which we could never do by ourselves. Now, Bill, just in case you're not convinced, he asked the question again. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution.
Middle-of-the-road solution. Take your time. Don't rush into taking the steps.